Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Michael McKellar. I'm the President Pro Tem, or at the moment, of the Australian Institute of International Affairs, Victoria. And it's my great pleasure to welcome you here tonight and in such prodigious numbers, which is really good to see. And it's a tribute to the speaker that we have. And it's an interesting thing about running an institute like this one, that if you get good speakers, that people and subjects that they're interested in, then people will turn up, despite the fact that it's the middle of winter and it's not particularly clement outside at the present time. The subject of tonight's address is the Middle East, where to now? And you may have noticed over recent months that there has been some widespread interest in what has been happening in the Middle East. And there is still widespread interest in what is going on there. And it's a great pleasure for us to have somebody who knows a very great deal about this subject, Dr. Michael Rubin of the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., to speak to us. Now, we're very thankful and grateful to the Australia-Israel Jewish Affairs Council for getting in touch with us and providing, as it were, the presence of Dr. Rubin here tonight. So thank the council very much. I think we've got some members of the council here as well, so welcome to you guys as well. Now, this, you may have got this little brochure, flyer, which tells you all about Dr. Michael Rubin. And this is important because it tells us why he is so well equipped to discuss this matter of the Middle East tonight. He's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He's senior lecturer at the Naval Postgraduate School Center for Civil Military Relations and a senior editor of the Middle East Quarterly. Between 2002 and 2004, he worked as a staff advisor for Iran and Iraq at the Pentagon, from which he was seconded to Iraq. He received his PhD in history from Yale in 1999. He's lectured in history at Yale, Hebrew University in Jerusalem, Johns Hopkins University, and at three different universities in northern Iraq. Couldn't you make up your mind? It's a very impressive list. He currently provides academic instruction on regional issues for senior U.S. Army Marine Corps and naval officers deploying to Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Persian Gulf. Now, when we're looking at the subject, Middle East, where to now, I can't think of anybody with broader experience and hands-on experience, given that history, than Dr. Michael Rubin. So would you please welcome Dr. Rubin.
Thank you very much. As that generous introduction said, I spent a good deal of time working at the Pentagon, and the one thing, the top thing I learned at the Pentagon when I left in 2004 is that PowerPoint is the work of Satan. So this will be the only PowerPoint slide you show. Now, after I left the Pentagon, I moved on to the American Enterprise Institute, where I still sit. And one of the drawbacks of working in Washington, whether you're on the left, whether you're in the center, whether you're on the right, of policy analysis and such, is there's a Murphy's Law. When you're under a writing deadline, that's when the TV producers call and want you to go across town. They always make me come a half hour early because they say my forehead shines too much, so they need to put stuff on it, and to do the talking head bit. And recently I was called by Fox News to give about 20 seconds on Afghanistan. And I went there. I went there. I did my 20-second soundbite. I came back to the green room, which is the waiting room where the next person up was waiting, a governor, and he had his whole entourage. I don't get an entourage. At any rate, one of his aides said, "You know, Michael, you look good up there." I said, "That's really funny because my wife had just called me and said, Michael, I thought you looked fat, bald, and mean." The governor looked up from his notes and said, "Nah, I didn't think you looked mean." The point of that is that when we get to questions and answers after our little tour of the region, by all means, don't worry if I look mean. I look forward to answering your questions. Now, I want to start off with Iran, and I'll talk briefly about Turkey and what the changes in Turkey mean for the region before finally looking at the Arab Spring. My goal here, and the takeaways from this talk, I hope, would be that I'll try to provide some insight, not necessarily answers, but insight as to what I believe might be going on and the problems which might develop over the horizon. I don't want to simply get up here and repeat what one reads in the newspapers every single day, because that would be a waste of everyone's time. So with regard to Iran, I want to both start in the past in 1979 and the future. And it's always dangerous when one starts their talk with the topic I'm going to discuss, demography, because that's a guarantee to make audiences fall asleep. But I hope not to do that to you, because it's essentially important in understanding the future role of Iran and where Iran might be going. When the Islamic Revolution happened, when Ayatollah Khomeini returned to Iran on February 1st, 1979, one of the first things he did was to decide that contraception was illegal. And posters went up across Iran which showed a good Islamic family with a mother, a father, and seven children. And sometime as this baby boom occurred, many of Khomeini's advisors came to him and said, look, with the Iran-Iraq war going on, with all the inefficiencies and all the turbulence of the revolution, we got to worry about the economy. And Khomeini used to wave them off and say, we didn't have a revolution over the price of a watermelon. But in 1988, when the Iran-Iraq war ended, Khomeini realized that you could indeed have a revolution over the price of a watermelon. And so he hit the books, looked at some hadith, looked at various books of Islamic jurisprudence, Shia jurisprudence, and discovered that indeed he had been mistaken and that condoms were very much legal. And posters went up across Iran that showed a mother, a father, and one child. And with the takeaway that this was a good Islamic family. But what does that mean for today, and what does that mean for the future? In June 2009, after the fraudulent election that led to Ahmadinejad having a second term, protesters poured out into the streets. And they do this on occasion. I was in Iran back in July 1999 during the last big round of student protests before the election protests a decade later. Fortunately, my parents thought I was in Barbados. At any rate, the takeaway from my talk is always lie to your parents. Now, the point of this is when you looked at the news media, and it doesn't matter what news media you look at, what was the age of the protesters who were pouring out into the streets of Iran? Most of them were in their 20s. They were either in the university or they were recent graduates, but they were of that age where they were very politically aware and concerned. But at the same time, most of them hadn't really started families. When you're in your 20s, you're a lot more apt to go out and protest and be an activist than you are when you're in your 30s and you may have become married, when you settle down, when you have to provide for a baby or babies. Now, what does this mean in context to demography? When we think about it, what we have, the protesters back in June 2009 represented the height of the baby boom from the Iran-Iraq war years. When you look at the official statistics, the birth rate in Iran right now is half of what it was in the 1980s. And the growth rate in Iran today is actually less than that of the United States, and about a third of that of Iraq, and slightly more than a half of that of Egypt. So the birth rate in Iran is plummeting. And where I'm going with this is really quite clear, and it's not just clear in academic circles. When you read a newspaper like Sobi Sadak, which is the weekly Revolutionary Guard newspaper, which is available online, they will talk about demography as being a key factor in the future of their security from the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps' point of view. What they believe is that for every year they can hold on to power, it will become easier for them to maintain that power at a cheaper cost, because there will be fewer and fewer protest-age 20-year-olds who replace the ones who graduate to stability, to have a family, and so forth. There's a natural tendency in the West to assume that once you let the genie of reform out of the bottle, that it's inevitable. It's just a matter of time that reform will triumph. Now, Iran is certainly different than the Arab states in the region, which have a very different demographic profile. But when it comes to Iran, the Revolutionary Guard themselves believe that the point of greatest danger is right now or in the past, and that every year we progress, as the population ages in Iran, that it will actually be easier for them to maintain control. Now, if it's easier for them to maintain control, then they have the ability, an ability that's amplified by very high oil prices, to perhaps go back to the issue of export of the revolution. An export of the revolution isn't a phrase that simply analysts outside Iran talk about, or warmongering Americans, or neocons, or what have you. It's enshrined in the constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And there's active debates in Iran about what export of the revolution means. A couple years ago, also in 2009, Mohammad Khatami, the former reformist president, was giving a speech at the University of Gilan, in which he was talking about export of revolution and what it should mean. What Khatami said was, when the imam, when Grand Ayatollah Khomeini, talked about export of revolution, he meant soft power. He meant building Iran into the Islamic Republic, into a utopia which all the neighboring states would automatically want to imitate. And Khatami went further, just in case people at the University of Gilan didn't understand. He said what Khomeini didn't mean was sponsoring resistance movements, sponsoring insurgencies, and so forth. And then Khatami concluded by saying, we've got to get back to Khomeini's true vision. This created an uproar in Iran. Why? Because, in effect, Khatami acknowledged that the Iranian government, was up to no good in certain regions, in Lebanon and Syria and so forth. And we've seen in Iran, for example, that if anyone here has ever been to Iran, and I spent about 7 months there, they used to call me Pesari Shaitani Bozorg, son of the great Satan. I regret saying this because it's going to be on tape, but when I first got to Iran, to the University of Tehran, when I was working on my doctoral dissertation and doing research in some of the archives there, they heard me speak Persian, and they said, oh, man, you speak Persian like an Afghan taxi driver. And they put me in a remedial institute at the University of Tehran, and so I was in with the Libyans, I was in with the North Koreans, and it was like my own little axis of evil. At any rate, the point of this is, Khatami, when he was talking about export of revolution, it created an uproar because he was acknowledging that the Iranians were up to no good. And some people called for Khatami's arrest in the so-called principalist camp, the hardliners. And he did what all politicians do. He said, hey, look, I was misquoted. The whole speech was on YouTube, though. He wasn't misquoted. And then next day, the deputy head of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps gave a big speech where he reaffirmed the opposite vision to Khatami of what export of revolution should mean. The takeaway from this is that if Iran feels more secure at home, there will be more opportunity for it to become involved outside Iran in the region. It will take a much more activist approach. And there's many different variables that matter in this. Now, I should say that most Iranians don't particularly care for their government. And this isn't just a subjective conclusion I make from what happened in 2009. It's a very good thing that Iranians don't have caller ID, because some professional polling outfits, some of which work for the government and also do private sector research, and what I'm quoting is actually an open source poll by the Terence Group. They will take every telephone exchange in Tehran, randomize the last four digits, so you get a good cross-section of neighborhoods and so forth, and do economic surveying. And the Iranians tend to be probably the most, they tend to be far more cosmopolitan than almost all the countries surrounding them, with the possible exception of Turkey. And Iranians really are quite cosmopolitan. You do economic surveying. Do you think you will have a better life than your children? Do you think your children will have a better life than you? How many of this appliance do you own? Has anyone in your family lost a job in the last couple years? That sort of thing. And when you do the professional statistical analysis on it, what generally comes out true is about 10% of Iranians truly believe in the Islamic Republic, the concept of Viliyati Faqih as it's practiced now. These are the followers of Supreme Leader Khamenei. Another 15% think that it was a pretty good idea, but it's just been misapplied. These are analogous to the glasnost and perestroika communists under Mikhail Gorbachev. And the other 75% of Iranians have completely given up on the system. That doesn't mean they're revolutionary. And you guys know the old Hatemi joke. Well, I hope you don't know it because I'm about to tell it. About an Iranian woman who's getting married on her wedding night. She tells her husband, "I probably should have told you this before, but this is actually my second marriage." Husband goes, "What?" Says, no, don't worry, I'm still a virgin." "How can that be?" "Well, my first husband was like Muhammad Khatami. He just kept promising to do it, and after 8 years, he didn't touch a thing." Most Iranians are quite apathetic, and with reason. Last time they had a revolution, they had a war that killed up to 1 million people. And it's simply not worth going through that trauma again. You don't know what's going to come out of a revolution. So you have this combination where the Iranian government feels that it can gain better control of the people. And even if most of the people are moderate, they, A, don't necessarily have a great deal of input into what their government actually does. And the second point is, even if only 25% of Iranians support the concept of Islamic Republic, I'd guesstimate that 90% of Iranians are fiercely nationalistic. And so if there is some sort of external crisis, that's a way in which the government, which may be unpopular, can rally the population around the flag. Now, the last point I want to make with regard to Iran before talking briefly about Turkey and then some of the Arab countries with regard to the Arab Spring has to do with the nuclear issue. And I don't want to get into the debate about whether Iran is building nuclear weapons or how far away Iran might be from having nuclear weapons or their capability. We'll save that for some of the debates on the op-ed pages and such. My main concern, and this is a variable, of course, a conditional. If Iran develops nuclear weapons, the question I want to ask is how will that impact secession inside the Islamic Republic of Iran? Because all too often we talk about the day Iran gets nuclear weapons capability, but we don't talk about what comes afterwards. And in this case, I would hazard to guess that if Iran does develop nuclear weapons, and I say if, that those who would have command and control over the nuclear program would not only be the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, but the most elite units, the most ideologically trusted units within the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Now let's talk about secession. Iranian rulers have a habit of living a long life. And Khomeini lived, I think he died, when he was 89 years old. You guys may remember that mass funeral. There was a heat wave. They were spraying water. The quip on the street was the old man was so senile, he forgot to close the door on the way down. At any rate, what happens when the supreme leader dies? In theory, you have an 86-member assembly of experts, a clerical body, which chooses the new leader. In reality, talking to people who were there in 1989, they say that's not really what happens. The Assembly of Experts acts as a rubber stamp body, and what happens behind the scenes is the regional elites will come up with a compromise candidate. They will decide among themselves informally and then present that candidate to the Assembly of Experts for the rubber stamp. Well, I would hazard to guess that if Iran has nuclear weapons and if a really ideologically trusted unit of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps controls those weapons, that you cannot have any supreme leader take charge in Iran that doesn't have the buy-in of that unit of the Revolutionary Guards, because they're not going to subordinate themselves to someone who they distrust. which raises the possibility, should Iran get nuclear weapons, that instead of having reform, there would be a self-fulfilling cycle of radicalization, where the Revolutionary Guard more or less has veto power over the Supreme Leader, and then the next Supreme Leader is the guy who picks the most ideologically pure Revolutionary Guards, who again then have power over the next selection. So we get ourselves into a situation that's tremendously complex, but in which reform, there are major impediments to reform. Now let me talk about Turkey, and certainly Turkey has been in the news recently, especially with the election this month, in June 12th, when Recep Tayyip Erdogan and the Prime Minister, the leader of the AKP, won third term and won nearly 50% of the vote. The immediate pundit and press reaction was that this is actually a good thing. And the former American Consul General in Melbourne, who rose to become the ambassador to Turkey before retiring, Ross Wilson, wrote a blog post from his new perch at the Atlantic Council in which he said, because the AKP fell short of a supermajority, that this is actually a good thing because they need to compromise as they write the new constitution. I would fault Western diplomats, however, for paying too much attention to the rhetoric which comes out of Turkey and too little attention to what the Turks are actually doing. Recep Tayyip Erdogan has been saying some wonderful things about compromise and dialogue, but since June 12th, he has actively been trying to disqualify some of the opposition parliamentarians who were elected by linking them to the so-called Ergenekon conspiracy, this amorphous coup plot which he has used to justify the jailing of pretty much anyone who has criticized him. And of course, you know, I think the current figures are there's about 70 journalists in jail for this as well. At any rate, I'm worried about where Turkey is going, and this impacts the Middle East and the Arab world as we talk about Turkey's increasingly activist role. Just a few facts. Well, the first is actually from the Turkish government itself, and it was picked up by Voice of America, that since 2002, the murder rate of women in Turkey has increased 1,400%. That has a lot to do with honor crimes, and that's something which has always been a problem. But the issue is that increase suggests that it's being done with impunity and that proper action isn't being taken to reverse it. The other issue which is of most concern to me is what's happening to journalists. If you look at Reporters Without Frontiers, they do an annual press freedom index. And the most recent one is from 2010. It's available online. Turkey ranks in press freedom now below Zimbabwe, below Venezuela, below the Ukraine and Egypt and Iraq, and only slightly above Russia. Now, Turkey is all, I mean, democracy is an evolution. And certainly South Korea has had difficult times as it has become a democracy. The important thing, as democracies suffer challenges, is to ensure that there are adequate checks and balances to preserve the democracy. In this case, for example, while I myself am happy that the military no longer has such a invasive role in Turkish politics, it's important to recognize the purpose, that the role that the military played in Turkish politics. It was basically there to guarantee the Constitution and as a check and balance. Now, it's all well and good to associate democratization with the decline of the role of the Turkish military. But at the same time, I would argue that American diplomats and Western diplomats in general have committed diplomatic malpractice by not encouraging at the same time a new independent civilian check and balance to constrain the power of any overly ambitious diplomat who doesn't want to abide by the Constitution. When the AKP had its some of its legislation vetoed by the Constitutional Court, Bulent Arendt, who's now the Deputy Prime Minister at the time, was the Speaker of Parliament, warned the Constitutional Court that if they continued this troublesome behavior of vetoing unconstitutional legislation, the AKP had the power to dissolve the Constitutional Court. That's not a good thing, and that's not something the West should let the AKP get away with. Certainly it's something we need to watch as Turkey plays an increasing role in the Middle East. Now, Turkey will oftentimes explain its intervention with regard to Iran and with regard to Syria and the Arab world in general by saying that they have a good neighbors policy. The problem is, and this was certainly shown by the Arab Spring, the Israel-Palestinian conflict is only one conflict within the wider Middle East. Much of what we saw in the Arab Spring, what we see in Syria, what we see in Lebanon, what we see in Egypt, what we see in Tunisia, what we see in Yemen, what we see in Iraqi Kurdistan, has absolutely nothing to do with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The protests are about accountability, the protests are about unfulfilled expectations, and so forth. Up until about a year or two ago, Syria didn't recognize Lebanon as an independent state and refused until recently to even have an embassy in Lebanon. Now, when Turkey plays a much more activist role, eventually it needs to make decisions on some of these conflicts that occur between other states that have nothing to do with Israel and the Palestinian territories or Palestine. For example, in the conflict between Lebanon and Syria that started with the assassination of Rafiq Hariri, unfortunately it seemed that Turkey came down on the side of Syria. Likewise, when it comes to Hamas. Hamas isn't a monolith. There's different factions within Hamas, which is why I find it problematic that the faction which it seems the Turkish government embraced was the Damascus-based faction, which is the most radical faction, and one that provides the greatest impediments to continuing the Arab-Israeli peace process. Now let me move on to the Arab Spring. Again, if demography didn't put you to sleep, let me try again, because I'm going to talk about election systems. If I make an analogy to the Islamic Revolution in Iran, Ayatollah Khomeini came back on February 1st, 1979, and the U.S. Embassy was seized on November 4th, 1979. There were almost 9 months of decisions, of policy debates, and so forth that occurred between those two events. The reason I bring up that timeline is just to underscore that what we're seeing right now in the Middle East is really the end of the beginning rather than the beginning of the end. And so much about the future shape of the Middle East depends on some policy decisions which need to be made now. Now, certainly, the West can't simply impose itself on the Middle East. There would be a reaction to that. But at the same time, there are ways to influence the evolution of the political systems which are now emerging. This is where I get into election systems. About 80% of Egyptians will say that the Muslim Brotherhood has every right to contest elections. But most Egypt experts and Egypt analysts agree that perhaps only around 25% of Egyptians would actually vote for the Muslim Brotherhood. Well, in election systems, I mean, two main polls, and let's put Australia aside for now, are the first-past-the-post election systems and the proportional representation election systems. In a first-past-the-post election system, it's pretty much winner-takes-all. Sometimes you have to get more than 5% and you have runoff elections and so forth, but the winner-takes-all. So if the Muslim Brotherhood as a bloc wins 25%, and then 10 other parties split the remaining 75%, let's just say, for the sake of argument, they get 7.5% each, the Muslim Brotherhood would end up dominating the political system. However, if we were to push for proportional representation elections, and I'm assuming that among many Western policymakers, they would like to see the Muslim Brotherhood not dominate Egypt, then you have a system in which the other parties which have split that vote can form a coalition and perhaps marginalize or at least moderate some of the Muslim Brotherhood influence on the government. And so it's policy decisions like that as we move towards reform And Turkey had a very quick election, referendum on some constitutional reform, but a lot of people talk about the need for further reform. It's decisions like that that moderate Arab states, various Western governments, can be inputting or are trying to input their influence in order to try to get an outcome which collectively we may believe is best for stability in the Middle East. But what worries me now isn't the first election we will have in Egypt or Tunisia or Yemen or elsewhere, but actually the second election, whenever that may be. And one of the key determinants of democracy is actually having more than one election. The Arab Spring wasn't simply about poverty, because the economies in Tunisia, the economies in Egypt and so forth were actually on the move. They were increasing. The Arab Spring was about government accountability, and it was also about unfulfilled expectations, much like the Iranian Revolution was when that occurred in 1979. Over the past decade, there's been a great deal of pressure for economic reform, for privatization, and so forth, across the Arab Middle East, across these former state-centered economies. But what did privatization mean to the average Egyptian, the average Tunisian, or the average Yemeni? Basically, to take the case of Egypt, it meant that a state-owned industry would be given to Gamal Mubarak, Hosni Mubarak's son, and it would be sold or whatever. But privatization was a way of enriching the elite. And so there's been a backlash to many of the financial reforms in the Middle East, in which polling and various other methods of determining opinion suggest up to 90% of Egyptians believe that the state should have a much greater role in the economy, not just in regulating certain prices, but also in guaranteeing jobs, guaranteeing housing, guaranteeing higher education, and so forth. No matter how much debt we forgive from Egypt or from any of the other Arab countries, and no matter how much aid we may give, in a situation like this, it's a recipe for economic collapse, or at least for expectations not to be met. And in such a case, what I would worry about is not the Muslim Brotherhood or less democratic forces now, but what might happen 2 years from now, 3 years from now. I don't place as much hope on the Egyptian military as some may. And look, the last time the Egyptian military was involved in a war was 1973, which means most Egyptians know their generals not as warriors but as businessmen, as protectors of the status quo. And so increasingly there's going to be a popular backlash against them as well. Now, in the last 2 or 3 minutes before we turn to questions and answers, I just want to highlight on a point-by-point basis some of the concerns and some of the challenges which we're going to have in many of the other countries in the region, the Arab countries who are undergoing Arab Spring demonstrations. A few years ago at the American Enterprise Institute, we did a project called Dissent and Reform in the Arab World, in which we took leading activists from pretty much every Arab country. And we brought them together, but we also had assigned them to write a report about what they saw as the chief impediments to democracy and reform in their own country. With the ground rule, they were only allowed to talk about what happened inside their own country. They couldn't do the useful, the common counterproductive aspect of just blaming outsiders or blaming Israel and the Arab conflict. And things arose that I had never really even thought of. In Yemen, there's actually free press. Anyone can start a newspaper. The problem is the government controls the newsprint. And so you have issues like that that need to be reversed. Libya is the country that actually worries me the most. Because in Libya, Gaddafi took power in 1969, but in 1973, after he got upset with Anwar Sadat, he broke with Egyptian influence, broke with Egyptian advisors, and this is when he started writing his Green Book, and he basically eviscerated the government. Regardless of what one thinks of the Iraq War, in Iraq, the army was dissolved for, 3 weeks? And think of all the problems that created. In Libya, the government and the structure of government has been dissolved for almost 40 years. And so you're really going to need a wholesale rebuilding. In Libya, too, because of the Green Book and because of the ideology which has been indoctrinated for generations, there's tremendous racism, especially towards black Africans. And this is why not only Libyan government forces, but also the opposition forces have both been targeting African migrant workers and so forth in Libya. There's also tremendous misogyny in Gaddafi's Green Book. Yemen. Right now, women aren't so empowered. But because of Yemeni history, not only going back biblically to the Queen of Sheba, who still does matter in Yemen, but also in the 12th century to Queen Arwa, who is known as presided over the height of Yemeni power during the Islamic era. While there currently aren't a lot of opportunities for women in the Yemeni government, mentally, people accept the idea of women in politics and women rulers. And so every country here is different. Syria, even though technically before Assad, Bashar al-Assad started killing wholesale the Syrian people, he said he dissolved the emergency laws. The problem here, and in reality he didn't, but the problem isn't just the emergency laws. Since the emergency laws were implemented decades ago, a whole bureaucracy developed in order to implement and monitor and secure issues relating to the emergency laws, which means, putting politics aside, people have in their interest in Syria the preservation of some of these, if not emergency rules, the preservation of the bureaucracy behind them. And so as we plan towards a post-Assad future, should that happen, it's important to recognize unique impediments on a country-by-country basis. We can talk more about this during questions and answers. I've filled my time and don't want to be one of those academics who just prattles on for hours. And perhaps it might be more interesting, and we can touch on any of these subjects or more, if we address this during questions and answers. And with that, I thank you very much.